We are going to have a Friday meeting, which everybody's aware of that.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, and so we'll start out by opening up a work session on Senate Bill 159. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 159 prohibits certain conduct by payday loan lender, requires payday lender to inform consumer complaint procedure, authorizes the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules to regulate payday loans, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are -1-2 amendments.
Okay, can we have somebody to come testify on the -1 and -2s?
Nobody's interested.
No one cares. Well, what do the -1s and -2s do?
Now, the -1s authorize electronic repayment, authorize an electronic repayment agreement. The -2s separates the regulatory administration of payday lenders from title lenders. It removes the requirement to inform consumer complaint procedure, permits only one fee for each loan transaction, authorizes the Department of Consumer Business Services to receive and investigate complaints, and removes duplicative authorization for DCBS to adopt rules regulating payday loans.
The committee will remember that we had a public hearing on this on the 26th of March. There were some issues that were brought up, and evidently the issues have been resolved by the -1s and the -2s. Is there any comment or discussion about those?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm a bit disappointed that Senator Metzger isn't here.
He's just coming in.
And he can maybe fill me in on what the deal is here. Okay. Senator Metzger.
Metzger, we were just talking about 159 and the -1s and 2s, and you were part of that work group. And we were just talking about the -1s and 2s, and Senator Walker is interested in finding out your viewpoint on this week.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have no problem with those. I think the big issue that I had with it was the enforcement actions and, you know, having the tools necessary. And after discussion with some of the parties, they discovered they had the tools, obviously weren't using them well enough, to enforce these actions. And my opinion is I'm comfortable with going ahead with the -2s, but one thing I will certainly do is have a discussion with our Ways and Means folks, and my intent is to see that a budget note is included in the budget of the department, that they use those tools effectively and give us a report next session as to how they have reduced the need for such a high non-compliance upon their inspections. So if they've got the tools, I'm comfortable with that. You know, I want the department is to use them and report back that they have successfully done that. And so I'm comfortable with it as the minutes are.
Well, I appreciate that explanation, Senator Metzger. And if you are planning on doing that by memo, I would be happy to sign on to that because we did have that testimony. They had the tools but weren't using them. And that's my issue here.
Yeah. It's the same concern.
So any other comments or concerns on either -1s or -2s? Chair would move the -1 amendments to 159. Comments, discussions, objections? So ordered. The chair would move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 159. Discussions? Objections? So ordered, and the chair would move. So we have to appropriate two members, or they're just
they'll be confined after this.
Okay. The chair moves Senate Bill 159 as amended by the -1 and the -2 amendments. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just my parting shot.
Sure.
My parting shot is that I'm still disappointed that we allow these kinds of businesses to operate in Oregon. The title lenders, I have more of heartburn over than the payday lenders. It's just unfortunate that Oregonians can't seem to manage their money enough that they have to resort to these kinds of businesses that charge lots of money to use their services. And that's my parting shot.
Great government can't do everything for everybody.
We can't. We try, but you know, one thing that we could do is have more financial education in our schools, which I actually have a bill up at 3 o'clock in education about doing that at college level.
Okay, very good. Any further comments? Any objections at all to 159 as amended being passed in the floor? Not so ordered. Yeah. And if you have any particular burning desire to carry that, or I can carry it. I'll just carry it, that's fine. Unless you want to have a payday loan. No, you don't like it.
I would just give another parting shot.
I'm just trying to give it all a chance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll open up a public hearing, or a work session, excuse me, on Senate Bill 215A. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 215A eliminates various set-asides for Oregon Business Development Fund, eliminates requirement of cities or counties to pass resolution support of a project, restricts county limit on loans, increases the maximum loan amount, and allows the Economic Community Development Department to make initial deposits for a capital access program. And there are dash A2 amendments.
As the committee will remember, this is the bill that we had it on the floor, and Senator Carter indicated some concern with page 3 of the bill, lines 8 to 31, on certain language as women and minorities. And I guess that's what the A2s have done. Is there any comment on...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir, Senator Byer.
And I'm looking... I know what Senator Carter's concerns were as she came and talked to me about it, because I was the carrier of the bill. And I guess I have to disagree with her interpretation of the meanings here, and I'm trying to get to the statute to plead my case. Her concern was that by deleting the words emerging small businesses, that by definition were minority women and minority owned businesses, and I'm looking at the statute where we are defining emerging small businesses, which is 200.005, that is being eliminated, so perhaps we need to restore the language on line 17, page 2, but emerging small businesses means, and we have an A through E, and none of which speak to women or minority-owned businesses. They are a business with its principal place of business located within this state, a business with average annual gross receipts over the last 3 years not exceeding $1 million for construction firms and $300,000 for non-construction firms, a business which has fewer than 20 employees, an independent business, and a business properly licensed and legally registered in this state. None of those, by defined by statute 200.005, have anything to do with minority or women-owned businesses, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So I guess I need to disagree with Senator Carter's interpretation of the meaning of that by eliminating those phrases on page 3, lines 18 through 28, and page 3 of the bill. Perhaps what the bill also did was delete this definition of emerging small businesses. Mm-hmm. So I find myself at a quandary. I don't want to, you know, our intention as a committee was not to delete, you know, the requirement of that in the statute. We support business or women and minority-owned businesses, but I don't believe that this bill did that as it is currently drafted.
Okay, so what would you suggest? Do you have any options for us to be looking at? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to point that out for the committee because I haven't had a chance to digest these amendments to see what they do, the A2 amendments, but I'm just pointing out that I don't believe this bill spoke to the issue that Senator Carter was concerned about when the bill was on the floor the first time.
I know Senator Carter isn't here, so and I don't want to speak for her, but I think Senator Byer, I think you're right in terms of the way in which the statute is written. I don't disagree with you at all. I think what Senator Carter's concern was is that emerging businesses, that minority and women-owned businesses predominantly, she believes, fit the category of the emerging small business. Most of them are emerging small businesses. So by deleting the language of the emerging small business, that the particular businesses, the subset of women and minority-owned, pretty well fit that, and so that it would indirectly have an impact on them because they all fit under that category. And I think that's kind of the conclusion that she would have reached on it. So that's just a way of an explanation as I understood her concern.
Mr. Chair, the testimony we originally received on this bill and the reason that in the original bill that the entirety of subsection 6 on page 3 was eliminated was the department said their constraints are that they have a hard time reaching or finding people who qualify as emerging small businesses, and if they could be able to use these funds for loans of any businesses in distressed areas, they would have a much, I mean, they could utilize this or the statute and the set aside portion. That's why they originally wanted to eliminate the entire set aside, because they said we can't find enough emerging small businesses. So we said, well, if the problem is that it's the emerging businesses, let's make it open for all small businesses or all in the distressed areas.
And I understand, Senator, your point exactly. And as Senator Carter, in our conversation on that particular point, I think feels that the fact that they haven't been able to loan the money is that they are not doing effective outreach. And she's saying that people that she's familiar with that would fit that category don't know anything about the program, and feels that that is a lack of effort on behalf of the department to inform. To outreach to these folks, that there would be opportunities to lend, except that she feels that the outreach has not been sufficient enough, and that by deleting that language, that that outreach certainly, if it's not happening now, won't help them happen then. And again, it's always hard to articulate someone else's view, but I think that's how she views that, as that it's not so much that they're not there, that the department needs to reach out more to find them and give them knowledge of the program.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Doris, would you come up
with somebody? I was thinking that we try to get a hold of Senator Carter, and I think she's in committee, and give her an opportunity to speak to this, and if we need to set this aside and come back to it when she comes back, is available, we might do that.
Let's listen to the department. What do you feel these proposed amendments and compared to the discussion that's been going on here? Give us your viewpoint of the world.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from Economic and Community Development Department, and with me is Mark Houston, who actually runs the business finance programs, and he testified at the earlier hearing about these set-asides. We did look through the amendments that were being proposed, and we talked to Senator Carter, and we understood what her concern was. And we frankly thought that if the amendments were correct as they're drafted, that we could still operate the programs. And we got out of the bill the major concerns we had. So given that, that's the situation, and we're certainly willing to do whatever Senator Carter needs to be sure that we're focusing on the right kinds of businesses. But I think the question that Senator Beyer raised is a good one, and I'd like Mark Houston to talk about that and see what he thinks we might do with that regard.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Houston. I manage business finance at the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And I know this is a little bit of history on how the bill has been modified. The initial proposal by the department was to move from a concept of set-asides to preferences. And what's been moved back is into the set-aside concept, if you will. We're fine with that, especially related to emerging small businesses in distressed areas. It is, and I will make this comment mostly for the record, but it is a pretty high bar to go into distressed areas and find emerging businesses. And our track record has been actually pretty good, I think, in that arena. We've the set-aside is 15%, and it's been a little over 13% of the loans have been made to emerging small businesses in distressed areas. So we are fine with keeping that set aside. It doesn't it keeps us focused on that agenda, which we would be anyway, and continuing to work on that agenda. It does have potentially some impact in the future, and we may be back to you next biennium to address this issue if that becomes more of a problem than it is right now.
Senator Beyer's concern, how would you
answer
that?
I'd like to suggest, Doris Penwell again, I'd like to suggest, we talked to the governor's office about the emerging small business definition, and it was their office that suggested that the old language that referred to four, I can't even read it because I crossed it out, it was the old language, was not any longer in the statute, and they were the ones that told us that 2000.005 was the correct reference, and I think for the reason that Senator Metzger indicated, what they tend to be the kinds of individuals that are in emerging small businesses. So they referenced this and thought that's what we ought to refer to. If you're concerned about that, you could put a period after the word individuals in the so that you don't say as defined by da da da. Because I think the definition itself pretty well defines what women or minority individuals is. That's my personal opinion.
And I would be fine with that.
Senator Beyer, are we answering any of your concerns here?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I understand the department is just trying to get a bill that will have help people satisfied. My concern is, and I know the part of the bill that they were most concerned about is the increase from $500,000 to $1 million in the amount that they can
plus the other side.
Loans or right. Enter into contracts for. I guess I, along with many other people in both the Senate and the House, have been critical. The department has not done enough to do this, and so I've worked to try to ease their burden so they can actually do the job we've asked them to do, and I'm afraid if we make these amendments, the AP reflect, we've put the handcuffs back on them. And so we're going to increase the amount of money they have to work with, but we're going to tie their hands so they can't do it. So why do the bill at all if that's the case?
What's your response to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, and appreciate your perspective on that. Certainly one issue was the increase in the loan amount. The other issue that was giving us, frankly, the most problem, there was a set-aside for loans under $50,000, and that is because of the size of business projects of increased because of the cost of doing business. That has been a major constraint, and there has been more put into that set aside. And this bill does eliminate that, and that is our major problem that's staring us in the face today. The issue on the set aside for emerging small businesses in distressed areas, and there's a companion to that a similar amount is set aside, if you will, for within constitutional limits for women and minorities. We are meeting those objectives, and we're fine with that, or nearly meeting those objectives. And so that does not put the handcuffs on, if you, as Senator Beyer says, but those two, if the other parts of the bill, in particular for loans under $50,000, doesn't pass, it would constrain us significantly.
Mr. Chair, could I ask for a clarification?
Sure.
Yeah. Did you say that there is another set-aside that for women and minority-owned businesses besides the set-aside for emergency small businesses?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, yes. And actually, it's on page 3 of the Angross bill, line 28. There is a, and it's not a, it's not a true set-aside because there are some constitutional limits related to women and minorities, but it says in the operation of the Oregon Business Development Fund, the commission and the department shall, to the maximum extent feasible and consistent within constitutional limits, seek to assure that an amount equal to the amount specified in subsection 6, which is 15% of the fund, shall be loaned to businesses owned by women and minorities. So that would be a similar set-aside, if you will.
Mr. Chair, I guess that...
And Mr. Chair, just before you end, it's not a set-aside as much as an objective, where I would see subsection 6 being a true set-aside. Subsection 7 is an objective for the department, which we strive to meet and have met.
Mr. Chair, with that explanation, I can understand where Senator Carter was getting information, I think, not by the changes to subsection 6, but probably by deleting the phrase assured that an equal amount specified in subsection 6 of the section be loaned. That is, I wasn't catching that is the section I think that she was probably most concerned with. And I would still, I guess, recommend or ask that we would restore the language in subsection 7, but keep the deleted language in subsection 6 that speaks of deleting the emergent small, certified emergent small, and operated by a certified emergent small business enterprise. We should have then satisfied Senator Carter's issue, because subsection 7 is the section that talks about the minority and women-owned businesses, and subsection 6 is dealing with the emergent small businesses. So I think maybe both of our concerns could be satisfied if we were to keep the language deleted in subsection 6 of the bill.
Doris Penwell from the department. My original discussion with Senator Carter was that she was most concerned about the language being deleted in subsection 7. Later on, I found out that in talking to other people, she was also concerned about the emerging small business language as well. So the discussion sort of went from one place to another, and I think subsequently then they decided that both of those things needed to be changed in this bill, and I believe there was some discussion with the governor's office about this as well. So that's how we arrived at the language we have now. So I would have to go back to the senator, I guess, and just ask, you know, what is the best thing she clearly thinks all of this is what should be done, but I guess we could check with her.
Of course, if she did, that we could recess this work session. Did you say Senator Carter?
I think she's in committee. I think she has Ways and Means Committee in the afternoon, but I would check with her office
then
try to get a hold of her before we adjourn today. I think that would.
We can try to do that, yes. I can certainly go try to find her.
We'll just recess this work
Thank
session.
Thank you. Okay, we'll do that. Thank you.
We'll bring it back. We'll recess the work session. It's not at all. 2:15 and try and clarify these issues. On Senate Bill 285.
Senate Bill 285 allows insurer or self-insured employer to request reconsideration of notice of closure for workers' compensation claim. It's MLAC approved. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact on statement issued. However, there is a DCBS fiscal statement that reflects no fiscal impact.
Okay, Mr. Kussel and Brad Witt. Oh, wow, imagine.
Are they in agreement?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I want to thank you for considering Senate Bill 285 today, and we ask for your support. In 1999, the Department of Consumer and Business Services looked at the functions within their agency and made some recommendations or suggestions about functions they were performing that maybe they didn't need to. And one of those dealt with closing workers' comp claims, which was a function that the workers' comp division did. There was a requirement in statute that certain claims had to go to the department to be closed, and the carriers could close the other claims on their own, or if they chose not to, they could send them into the department and they would close them. And and DCBS came back and said, you know, that's really an administrative function of an insurance company. So they recommended eliminating that function, and that was passed in 1999 with the support of Management Labor Advisory Committee. But what happened when we eliminated the evaluation unit is that the notices that were given to close a claim had two different names. If I closed it myself, it was called a notice of closure. If the department closed it, it was called a determination order. And under the statute, either party could appeal a determination order, but only the worker could appeal the notice of closure. So when we passed the legislation in 1999, we didn't change the statute that dealt with the notice of closures. Senate Bill 285 does that, and what it allows is that a carrier or self-insured employer who closes their own claim has the right to appeal that order, just like they had the right to appeal the determination order. And one of the things I think it's important to point out is that when you close a workers' comp claim, this is one of the reasons they eliminated the evaluation unit, you have to use the attending physician's findings. And so And the standards are pretty strict. So whoever closes a claim is going to come up with essentially the same answer based on the attending physician's findings. And so Senate Bill 285, from our perspective, simply gives carriers and self-insured employers the same ability they had when the department closed claims, in that they could appeal it if they if they had reasons to, just as the worker can. And we would appreciate your support on this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Witt, Oregon AFL-CIO, here today to support Senate Bill 285. This issue was brought before the Management Labor Advisory Committee for Workers' Compensation by certain elements of the employer community as an issue of basic fairness in terms of claims closures in those specific instances which Lisa just alluded to. And it was recognized as an inequity by the MLAC committee, and I think that this is an indication that the MLAC is functioning as the legislature had intended. A recognized inequity has been addressed, and MLAC voted to move forward and support this bill unanimously. And on that basis, Mr. Chairman, committee members, we urge your support as well.
Questions for the committee or for the panel? I would note for the record that we do have a fiscal impact statement.
Zero.
But it is, came back, there's no fiscal impact statement. Any further discussion? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill
285. Close public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 285.
I move Senate Bill 285 to the floor, unamended, with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 285 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection to that? Motion is carried. I guess I can carry it. Unless everybody has a burning desire to do that, I'll carry it. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 514. Mr. Buss.
Senate Bill 514 specifies that applicant for license as public accountant does not have to receive passing grade in any section of examination related to business law, provides that public accountant's first license after January 1st, 2002 may not perform audits, and there's dash one amendments. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Very good. Carol. Mr. Hughes, do you want to clarify this? Welcome.
Oh, you haven't seen Carol in a while.
Where have you been?
Would you like me to go first? Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing us, the Board of Accountancy, to come before you on this matter. My name is Carol Reeves. I am the administrator for the Board of Accountancy, and the Board has proposed the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 514. The Board believes that the Dash 1 Amendment provides a more equitable treatment of licensees, public accountant licensees, and also provides a better ability for the Board to carry out its mission to protect the public. As you know, the Board of Accountancy licenses certified public accountants and public accountants. The eligibility licensing requirements are different for each of those designations. One of the differences has to do with that famous uniform CPA exam that you have already heard so much about. Currently, CPAs are required to take and pass all four sections of the CPA exam. Public accountants are required to take and pass three sections of the CPA exam. Prior to 2002, public accountants were required to pass two sections of the exam, and one of those sections was the audit section. Their practice thereafter was not restricted to audit. They could perform audit functions. legislation that was passed in 2001 removed the requirement that public accountants would be required to take the audit section of the exam and also place the audit restriction on the practice of all public accountants. The board does not feel that this is an equitable treatment of those licensed public accountants who were licensed before the legislation went into effect, nor of those exam candidates who were in the process of taking the exam and after passing two sections, including the audit section, because that's how they began the exam, that they then would be restricted from performing audit services. This would be a retroactive application of law to folks who were not subject to that when they gained their eligibility for licensing. Although the number of licensed public accountants and exam candidates for the public accountant licensing is small, the board nevertheless believes that it is an unfair treatment. As to Section 1 of the bill, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I know you remember that we have previously discussed the computer-based exam that is coming forward. And it is unclear to us exactly what Section 1 of the bill proposes, but it appears to eliminate any requirement for public accountant candidates to take any section of the CPA exam that relate to business law. Now, I have researched this according to the sections of the exam that are going to be given under the computer-based exam, because that is the one that will be going forward. After two more paper and pencil exams, the sections will change. And under the computer-based exam, there are two sections of that exam that have to do with business law. One of them has to do with ethics, taxation, and business law. And most public accountants have a practice that is primarily composed of tax practice. So that is a section one would not want to eliminate. The ethics portion of the exam, of course, is not one that the board would feel compelled to eliminate. The other section that has to do with business is entitled the Business Environment and Concepts. And this exam section is essential for providing competent services for business clients. And certainly public accountants in communities have clients who own businesses and need competent advice. The board believes that elimination of either of these sections as a requirement for licensing would be detrimental and would be in derogation of their mission to protect the public. We certainly seek your support to the Dash 1 amendments, and thank you for your attention.
Chairman, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Ted Hughes, representing today the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. That trade association is made up of tax preparers, tax accountants, enrolled agents, public accountants, and yes, even some CPAs. This bill was brought to you by the association legislative committee. Asked us to introduce this to get in a discussion about the business law section more than anything else. I did some personal research with my membership and found out that there's no reason to eliminate the business law now. It was introduced because of a historic mistrust that my association has with the Board of Accountancy. A mistrust that says, are they controlling entry-level jobs into the public accountant CPA business? And we're constantly aware of that. I found no evidence of that. And under this current board and Carol's leadership, it has been very fair and equitable and handled in a very professional manner. So that boogeyman is a phony boogeyman. And the amendments that Carol has offered, or the state board has offered, we're in total agreement with. Having said that, that's all I'd like to say about the bill. Dash one is just fine.
So with amendments, Carol, you believe this is your plan?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do. We believe that it addresses the retroactive application, which I believe was placed in the statute inadvertently, and it removes the proposal that these licensees should not take a certain section of the exam.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The only two folks that signed up to testify. Closed public hearing, open to work session. Senate Bill 514.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 514.
Senator Walker has moved the Dash One amendments to Senate Bill 514. This discussion. Everybody's any good about it? Okay. Any objections? If not, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 514 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 514 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Any objection? So ordered. Do you want to carry that?
I haven't done an accounting bill yet.
Thank
you.
I love numbers.
We have Senator Carter and Doris, would you please come back up and we'll reopen the recess hearing on Senate Bill 215. Welcome, Senator. We're trying to work through this issue and wanted you here to discuss. Now, Senator Byer had some concerns about what the bill is going to do, set-asides and preferences and all those sort of things. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Margaret Carter, House District 22, North Northeast Portland. Would you rather me to give some comments or I'm here for questions?
Now, Senator Byer, why don't you explain what your concerns were and then...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Carter, I think, assume you meant Senate District 22, but maybe you meant House District, I'm not sure.
Yeah. They've been changed around. I was one of those upside down people. I was at Senate District 9, and then after things changed, it's Senate District 22.
Well, I'm Senate District 9 now.
Uh huh.
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, let's get away from the gerrymandering.
I know.
We can talk about elevators if you want.
22nd floor, please. Well, that's right, Mr. Chairman. It's 22nd floor. Lingerie and all the other things that you like to have.
Senator Carter.
Yes, sir.
I talked to you on the floor about this bill when it was there and it came back to committee, and you're concerned that by removing the language that speaks to emerging small businesses, what it would be affecting minority and women-owned businesses. The chapter, the definition of emerging small businesses is not the same as the minority and women-owned businesses. I read a little while ago for the committee the definition. So I agree we should restore the definition of the emerging small businesses. But I think it comes down to now that you were concerned about women and minority-owned businesses and the fact that if we made the changes to the law that the Ingross bill suggested, we would be hurting or removing some of the incentives for the department to seek out those businesses. My question is, subsection 7 of the bill, on page 3, line 28 through 31, that is the section that speaks to women and minority-owned businesses. And I would agree that we should probably restore the deleted material on that line to alleviate your concerns.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I need to date myself a little bit. In 1985, when I first came to the legislature, the most distressed communities in this state was Coos Bay and North Northeast Portland. In 1989 and 91, the Croson versus Virginia case came out where preferences were eliminated. In working with the Attorney General's office at the time, we looked at the data and looked at the law, and certified emerging small business came out as it broadened the category for who was communities that was distressed, who were minorities, and that language. And so certified emerging small business was the language of the day that still allowed support for these small businesses and also was in keeping with the legal language of the day that did not absolutely say preferences. And so any removal of language that deals with certified emerging small businesses or any loan programs therein would remove the opportunity for women, other minorities, people. I think that the language was so broad, is like Portuguese and really broad language, would be negatively affected in statute. And so when you remove that language, that's what you're virtually doing at that particular time. And that's why, Mr. Chairman and Senator, my feathers become a little unfurled when that happens, because then all the work of the 80s and the 90s look like it goes away before my eyes. So forgive me for feeling so passionate about it, but that's exactly what you would be doing.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the history that the good senator from Northeast Portland has, but if we have the definition in statute, which we are, you know, bringing back in, and the definition does not include that, I guess I would have to differ that if you eliminate the under 430.347 sub 2, which is the definition of minorities, and replace that with the definition of minority individuals under 200.005, we still are going to have that definition of minorities, but if we keep the definition of emerging small businesses as defined by 200.005, we will in fact be saying that there are two different things, minority individuals and emerging small businesses, and I think that we would actually be trying to defeat what Senator Carter is trying to do. That is my opinion. I do not have the history that she does in this area, but it seems that if you are doing both of those, you are defining two different things in this, by using the definitions already in statute, so you are going to be creating two different elements.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know what is the intent of the committee in removing the language, as to why, is there a problem or something, Senator, as to why the language is here? Because I would have to work with the Attorney General's office again if any of the context of this language was changed to find out what the effects would be.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I agree with you. I think we need to, you know, restore the language that puts those definitions in. But my concern is that then subsection 7 speaks to the women and minorities, and we probably should rephrase that to members of minority individuals, so it would mirror the definition in statute that we are referencing, and that would be on line 31 on page 3. But my concern was the department under sub 6 was that the problem was not in finding work in distressed areas. There's plenty of work for them to do in distressed areas. It's the fact that they are limited by this preference to certified emerging small businesses, and that is the problem. And that's why my suggestion was to just eliminate the words of certified emerging small business, you know, so that they're still forced to work in distressed areas, but they can broaden the group of businesses they can work with.
Mr. Chairman, if we were to look at, and pardon my simplicity about this and maybe my lack of understanding even, Senator, but it would appear to me if the state of Oregon were investing, let's say, in Coos Bay, Oregon, $5 or $10 million project, and in this $5 or $10 million project, all this language would do is to say that in establishing this project in Coos Bay, Oregon, then it is important for you to look for emerging small businesses in that area, certified emerging small business in that area. When you're looking for certified emerging small business, it does limit who is a part of the certified emerging small business. But it would appear to me also, Mr. Chair, that if you had $10 million and maybe $950 million of that would go to the broader community and $50 million was $50,000 or $500,000 were saved for that small community, I don't think that that's asking a lot.
Mr. Chair, could I interrupt and answer a question? Senator Carter, one of the comments made by Mr. Houston sitting next to you was that it was hard to find emerging small businesses in distressed communities.
I have, Mr. Chair, Senator, excuse me, I have said until, and I hate to create puns, so excuse me, let me just think without saying something that is a pun. Okay. I have said over and over again that if the department, when a department goes into communities, and if it spent some of the time that they have in looking for emerging small businesses, and if there are no emerging small businesses in those communities, and there's a project going on, it would appear to me that they would have some kind of rulemaking opportunity by which that they could do what they need to do in that community. But I just can't believe that in the state of Oregon that there are not emerging small businesses. There are white females, the fastest growing business, that white females and Hispanics, the fastest growing small business entities in this state. I cannot believe that the department, and I'm sitting right next to Mr. Houston, cannot find an emerging small business in any community in this state. And I just don't believe, Mr. Chairman, that this language should be moved, that there should be some kind of means by which all Oregonians can enjoy the economic prosperity of this state. I firmly believe that. And I don't think this language is asking too much of that to be done. Senator, I beg of you to support this bill and to put this language, to let this language stay in this bill.
Mr. Chair, I guess as I stated before the Senator got here, I have been one of many in this body who have been critical of the department not doing enough in the past, and I'm trying to work. This bill is one of the tools to try to make them more effective in the job, and I feel that if we leave this language in the bill, we are asking them to do something that they told us they can't do. This is one of the strengths that makes it very difficult for them to do their job.
And I'm saying, I respectfully say to you, I don't believe that's true.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the good senator and I would agree with her that we need to restore the language on line 30 that has been removed. I didn't, when we talked about removing that language, I didn't realize what that, removing that language would do. I think that is the section that deals with minority and women-owned businesses. I would agree with her. We need to restore the language on line 17, page 2 of the bill. I agree with her. We need to change the reference of the definitions on lines 15 and 16, page 2 of the bill. I cannot agree that we need to restore that language that has been removed in the A version in subsection 6 and in subsection 1 of the bill. I think that is going to ask the department to do a job that they told us to do, very difficult to do, and we're trying to help them do their job, and that is my goal. I'm not trying to, you know, go hurt women, because I agree with the senator. I want the department to go to all communities, and that's why I was opposed to removing the cap on that a certain amount can go to a certain individual county, because I think the department needs to work across all communities, especially rural distressed communities. But if we do that and they say they can't do it, then I'm trying to find a way to untie their hands.
Mr. Chairman, and I think we're all on the same page related to the objectives here. And from the department's perspective, we're very interested in working in distressed areas of the state and working with women and minorities and trying to find all the projects that we can. And frankly, you know, just to set the record straight on some of this issue, this, as I testified before, the other issues of the bill really are the major issues. This was really a minor issue from our perspective. There's 15% set aside for economically distressed communities for certified emerging businesses, and we're achieving 13%. So we're very close to achieving that objective. So the question, the bill was written to make this a preference rather than a set aside. So it really is more of a language issue than an effort issue. Our efforts are still going to be in distressed areas of the state and for emerging businesses. For women and minority businesses, the set aside again is 15%. It's our objective is 15%, and we're achieving 17%. So again, we're meeting those objectives, and the question is whether or not to make this a preference rather than a set aside. And this issue is not a major issue from our perspective. The other issues that are in the bill are. And we're fine with the language as it stands. So if that helps from the committee's perspective, and we do appreciate Senator Byers' issues and concerns related to this, and appreciate his support of the department's bill. So, if that's helpful.
The unanimous action put it back to a set-aside rather than a preference.
Correct. And that, and again, for these issues, for women and minority, and for distress certified emerging small businesses in distressed areas, we're meeting those objectives or nearly there. So it's not an issue. But for loans under $50,000, we have a major issue in that agenda, and that this bill does take care of that issue. So if that's helpful.
That's good. I think in my view, one of the chair's preferences, I think we've got to move this bill, and if there are some issues, we can continue to work it. But I think as the time is getting longer, we better start pushing this thing down. Is that fair from the committee's viewpoint?
Mr. Chair, I agree with the department. This bill is really important because my community is impacted by this bill. We just had a major, major employer shut down, laying off almost 300 workers in addition to other employers. And we're not a rural area, we're an urban area, but we are in distress, and this bill will assist us. And so I think the bill is really important. These are minor differences, and I think we should go with the dash two amendments and move the bill. Unfortunately, we're not making everyone happy.
There's still time for you. Senator Nelson?
I might have one more question. I think try and wrap this up with Senator Carter's presence here. If we adopt the amendment, which was restoring the language that Senator Carter has articulated as important to her and to the state as she has pointed this out, would you please tell me what are the limitations, if we restore this on the record, if any, that are substantive by going the direction that Senator Carter has said?
Mr. Chairman,
you told me the other things are really important. I want to know what are the realistic limitations where we go forward on this, so that maybe we don't have to address this further down the road here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I think the limitation at this point, and again, because we're close to meeting this objective, what we have set aside right now for loans for emerging small businesses in distressed areas is a little over $500,000 as of June 30th, 2002. That, from our perspective, is a number that's not huge in the scheme of this fund, but it does as money's. As projects come through and monies dwindle, if you will, as loans are made, it could indicate that we would be working only for projects that would be for certified emerging small businesses in distressed areas, and that is the policy as the bill is written and as the statute is written, and that's what we will implement. So that is the only issue, and again, it is not. It is not a major issue from our perspective, and we will, and in working with Senator Carter and other and others in the distressed communities across the state, work to find projects and move the balance of the monies out.
And if I could follow up, just to use the words that Senator Beyer has said in terms of, freeing your hand, you from the handcuffs. Do you see any realistic handcuffs that you will be placed in by restoring that language as per the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, no.
Thank you.
Any further comments?
I see a train moving down the track. I'm going to get out of the way.
Well, the chair's preference to move this bill to the floor and to do the past recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, am I free to go now?
If this bill went out of council, would you like to carry this bill?
No problem.
You would like to?
Yes,
just in case. I don't know. I'm not
and
doing well.
I don't mind. I'm a servant, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and giving your viewpoint. Thank you. Work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash two amendments then.
Senator Walker has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 215. Comments, discussions, objections?
I've made my comments. I'd like the reporters to know on the motion, please.
Okay. But please let the record reflect that Senator Beyer has noted no on the dash two amendments. But the dash two amendments are carried.
And Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 215 as amended back to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senate Bill 215. Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 215 as amended to the form of two pass recommendations.
Object.
You won't?
I don't like the amendment, but I still want to move the bill forward.
Okay, so let the record reflect that the motion to pass the bill as amended to the floor is passed with unanimous vote. So we'll have Senator Carter will be assigned to carry the bill. I think Senator Lyra was...
Nope, I didn't want to carry it again.
Perhaps maybe you didn't want to do that. Okay, so then 514, Senate Bill will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 563, public hearing on 563. Mr. Dobbs.
Senate Bill 563 eliminates the ability of insurer or self-insured employer to make written clarification in response to workers' objection to notice of acceptance of admitted condition. Modifies basis for award of attorney fee to worker's attorney in certain circumstances, includes certain initial claims for compensation and meaning of denied claims. Was NLAC approved? There's currently no subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There are dash two amendments, and the WCB indicates that there would be a small fiscal impact.
Just for the record, let it reflect that the impact was $97,000. 2003 by him, and 125 in the 2005. It's come to our attention that there has been some disagreement over this bill, and let's continue with some of the testimony and see where we're going to. I don't know what the $97,000 impact is.
Mr. Chair, yes. May I ask a question about that?
Sure.
I see those are other funds. What are the sources of the funds?
Yeah, I...
The other funds included rulemaking, review, is what they've listed.
But what are the source? It's not general fund dollars.
It's a medical review officer.
But where does the money come from? What's the source of the other funds?
Yeah.
I mean, perhaps someone from the department could answer that question when they come up to testify.
Wow. John, where?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. To answer the Senator's question, Mr. Chair, these would be other funds that come from the premium assessment on workers' compensation insurance, and they're in the premium assessment operating account.
Do you want to step here and testify on this bill, or do you have any other testimony that you'd like to present, Mr. Chair?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Hand this to the clerk.
Mr. Chair, I guess while he's still here, will this increase of $97,000 and then $125,000, in Mr. Schultz's opinion, would that require an increase in the assessment to employers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I doubt that. This would make up approximately, catching up on my notes here, excuse me. About in the 03-05 biennium, just over $97,000, and then in the 05-07 biennium, and bienniums there going out, about $125,500 a biennium. This is a pretty small increase in the scope of our overall budget. We actually are projecting that the premium assessment is going to be coming down fairly significantly. If you add... It's hard to predict all the things that may happen to increase costs, but I really don't think this is going to have a an impact to push the premium assessment up. It's a pretty small amount. The other thing I would like to say is that we're in the department. This was a tough bill to do a fiscal on for us because it's hard to predict all of the effects, and I will cover some of that in my testimony. We wanted to be fair. We wanted to show the potential fiscal impact. We did the best job that we could in putting this together. There are it is based on some estimates and based on some assumptions. But what I really want to say is we're going to try very hard not to be a barrier for this bill. In other words, I do want to say it's possible that the division can absorb the additional workload that generates this fiscal impact. That's also a possibility.
And one of your statements, and just going to inquire, you mentioned that it might be $500,000 additional cost of workers' compensation system as a whole. But you're going to get into that. So why don't you go ahead and do testimony?
Okay, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm John Schultz, the Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here today primarily to provide information on Senate Bill 563 and the Dash 2 amendments. Basically, this bill, as it's amended, would provide an injured worker's attorney an attorney fee under certain circumstances that I'm going to outline in a minute. Any attorney fee that's awarded is to be paid by the insurer. Senate Bill 563 authorizes the adoption of rules establishing the amount of the fee, giving primary consideration to the results achieved in terms of the benefit that's provided and the time devoted to the case. Now, the Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed this bill at their March 31st, 2003 meeting. They did not actually review the Dash 1 or the Dash 2 amendments, but they were provided information about them. They heard testimony indicating that the parties were in conceptual agreement on how this bill would amend the statutes. And in summary, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, in summarizing this bill, stated that the department would provide rules for a matrix on the fees, that the matrix would be based on the estimated value of the benefit to be achieved and the time the attorney spends on the issue, and the maximum fee would be $2,000 except in some extraordinary circumstance. And based on that direction, the Management Labor Advisory Committee then voted to support Senate Bill 563 with amendments. The overall effect of this bill is going to be to provide more incentive for attorneys to represent injured workers in medical and vocational disputes, as well in some alleged potential penalty situations where a worker's benefits have been unreasonably delayed. This is likely to result in workers prevailing in more of these disputes because they're going to get representation that they don't always receive today. We do hear from workers fairly regularly that it's difficult to find representation on these particular issues because worker attorneys do not receive fees for prevailing in these cases, or in one case, the fee comes out of the penalty that's awarded to the worker. It's split 50-50 between the worker and the attorney. Specifically, what this bill is designed to do is, in the area of the penalty that I just mentioned, it's going to provide for the assessment of the penalty when an insurer has been found to be unreasonably delay or unreasonably refuse to pay compensation or to accept or deny the claim. The penalty can be as high as 25% of the amount that's due to the worker. That's all basically in current law. Now, what changes is if an attorney represents the worker, instead of getting one half of the penalty that's awarded to the worker, which is in current law, the attorney's going to get an attorney fee based on being instrumental in the process, and the entire penalty would then be paid to the worker. What this bill also does is when there is a medical or a vocational dispute that's before the director of the department, when the injured worker prevails in that dispute, the bill requires the director to assess an attorney fee based on rules that we would develop. And I did mention the parameters around those rules that the Management Labor Advisory Committee provided. And I'd mention again, it asks us to give primary consideration to the results achieved or the benefits achieved by the worker and the time that's devoted by the attorney, subject again to that $2,000 maximum unless there's an extraordinary circumstance. Mr. Chair, getting to your question that you mentioned earlier, the Workers' Compensation Division does estimate there's going to be additional cost to the workers' compensation system as a result of this bill. And we're estimating that to be somewhere between $500,000 and $700,000 annually. Now, this is going to come basically from two areas. Attorney fees being assessed where they're not currently assessed today. And then secondly, from the presence of attorney fees, we expect that's going to stimulate some additional disputes that attorneys will involve themselves in. We think this cost increase is fairly minimal when you look at the overall cost of the workers' compensation system, which is about a $600 million cost annually. So we're projecting that those cost increase would be somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2% of the total cost of the system today. And then we did talk already about the projected fiscal impact to the department. So I'd be glad to answer any questions that I can.
I'm just wondering, is this really much of an incentive for attorneys? I'm just thinking if your attorney's fees are $100 an hour, you'd be putting $20 in. Is that enough time to properly represent somebody? I mean, you probably don't get into that, but do you have any opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert in that area at all. I'm not an attorney, and I do know that attorneys in many other fields do charge an hourly rate. Typically, attorneys in the workers' compensation arena are working on a contingency basis, and they get a portion of the benefit or a set fee based on a schedule today. So this would not be the concept here is not dissimilar to what's used in other areas of workers' compensation. I imagine that given that we are talking about attorney fees, there would be endless opportunity to debate the adequacy of those fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, in your projection of a 0.1 to 0.2% increase in the to the cost of the system, the way I recall it, last session, Senate Bill 485, your projection was about a 2% increase to the system with Senate Bill 485. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's correct. We were projecting last session, about a 2 to 3% impact on the premium side of the workers' compensation system. Yes.
Thank you. So that didn't happen, or at least it hasn't happened yet. Or if rates fell enough to the offset, because we've seen no increase in the last 2 years in workers' comp in the rates. But my question would be, I guess, is there a snowball coming that we haven't seen? Other states around us, Washington, for instance, I think their rates increased, 30% or something like that in the last year. So factoring in 45 potential of that still coming, some others' decision, haven't seen the full impacts of that yet. Can you give me a sense of what, this is 0.1 to 0.2% is nominal, but I'm concerned whether or not there's a snowball or an avalanche coming to hit us that we should be aware of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think you're very correct in terms of your assessment of SB 485. We have not seen necessarily either the effect that we expected we might see from that bill, or perhaps the effect just hasn't materialized yet in terms of some of the provisions of that bill. So we too have been concerned about the cost of workers' compensation insurance, and are we going to see an increase here in Oregon? We've been very fortunate in comparison to other states nationally. We have had 13 straight years where we've either not had an increase or we've had a decrease in the cost of workers' compensation insurance, and I think that's extremely important given the state of the economy today. It's good to have something that's working well for us here in Oregon in terms of the cost of workers' compensation premiums. But to get specifically to your question, Senator, do we see a potential cumulative effect coming from previous bills and this bill? It is possible that we're going to see the end of the ride that we've been on here in Oregon in terms of the dropping premiums. Primarily, what has been driving that is the number of claims that are being filed in the workers' compensation system. Both here in Oregon and nationally, we are seeing a decline in the number of workers' compensation claims that are being filed. Now, additionally, in Oregon, because of the reforms primarily, and I think because of strong claims management practices that are going on in this state, and return to work and safety practices, we also see that when claims occur, the cost of those claims have been going down as well. There are factors. There may be some clouds on the horizon. Past legislation such as 485 may play a hand in this, but I think perhaps more ominous might be medical inflation that's hitting us here in Oregon as it is hitting nationally. Could be a bigger factor even. So will the cost of workers' compensation insurance go up here in Oregon? It very well may. Our last work that we did last fall on workers' compensation premium rates, we held the line. We held it at zero here in Oregon. But for the first time in 13 years, we didn't have a decrease either. So have we hit the floor, and are we now going to see some rates beginning to go up? It's possible that we will. I don't believe that they're going to go up dramatically. I don't believe we'll see the kind of rate inflation that California and Washington have been seeing. I think there are other factors that are present there that are driving those rates that we don't have here in Oregon. So my guess would be, yes, they could go up. How much? I don't think they're going to go up that much if they do.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Call Brad Witt and Chuck Lundeen. Brad, you want to start this?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Brad Witt, Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing today in support of the bill. We think that this is another issue, Mr. Chairman, of basic fairness in the workers' compensation system. In those instances where attorneys make a substantial contribution in terms of deciding the outcome of a medical services or vocational services issue before the Department of Consumer and Business Services, then it is entirely appropriate and fair that those attorneys be compensated for their services. Real world situation, Mr. Chairman, the average injured worker, when they enter workers' compensation, are probably ill-equipped, absent an attorney's help to deal with that system. And it is somewhat intimidating, particularly for folks who don't deal with these issues on an everyday basis. And so for them to be able to rely on an attorney's services is really essential. I want to allay any concerns that anyone might have about this being a quote-unquote get-rich scheme for the attorneys. It is not. A $2,000 cap is certainly, I think, set significant parameters on the maximum amount of fees that can be obtained in these services. And in addition, as you heard from Mr. Schultz, MLAC has recommended that there be parameters and actually a matrix developed that will say, given these level of services, this is the fee that the attorneys would be eligible to receive. So again, as a basis of fairness and a need for injured workers to have these services, would recommend that the committee pass favorably on this bill. And I neglected to hand out my written statement, which I'll give to the clerk.
Welcome.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Lundeen. I'm chief counsel at Liberty Northwest Insurance. I had hoped to be sitting here today testifying in favor of this bill. And we've had significant discussions with the workers' compensation trial bar about the bill. Everything Brad has said is exactly right. It's a complex system, especially in these department disputes where we've taken a number of disputes away from the hearings division, put them in the department, and lawyers are not there's no mandatory fee mechanism in that. So What we had talked with the trial bar about was a cap and was an agreement with them prior to passage of this bill on what this fee structure would look like. I testified in favor of this bill at MLAC along the lines of a balance between fairness to the worker, getting them a good representation, and yet not promoting litigation by an excessive fee structure. As Mr. Davey from SAFE testified, the devil's in the details, and we have not worked out the details. Hence, Liberty Northwest is testifying currently in opposition to this bill. The bill does discuss attorney fees in two areas, one associated with a penalty, as John Schultz testified. I think probably more importantly are these disputes in the department where currently it's a discretionary fee and there has to be a contested case hearing. Lawyers love hourly fees. As one who manages litigation, I can tell you that. And what we saw, we don't want to be paying, in our view, $175 to $250 an hour on cases on some sort of just hourly basis whereby the type of dispute involved are largely determined on a paper record. They are pretty straightforward disputes. They're seeking payment of medical bills and other items by workers. You don't want to be paying a $1,000 fee for a $50 medical bill that someone writes one letter and that sort of thing, but has a number of hours attached to that. So again, our disagreement with where this sits currently is we would like more detail and an agreement on the what this matrix looks like prior to supporting the bill. In concept, we've supported the bill. We feel it is a fairness issue. But again, we don't have an agreement on a matrix. We know there will have to be rulemaking, but what we had hoped was certainly Liberty Northwest and probably the employer community and labor and the trial bar could go to the rulemaking process together with the concept that, you know, that they'd agreed on and some details related to that.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lundin, I'm not quite sure what you're complaining about. I'm looking at the Dash 2 amendment, and it clearly says in the Dash 2 amendments, lines 5 through 11, that the fees assessed shall be proportionate to the benefit of the injured worker. The board shall adopt rules, and the attorney fee award shall not exceed $2,000. How much more explicit do you need it to be?
Well, it can be very explicit, Senator Walker, and it's not rocket science to get there. We've proposed a matrix which to serve as a discussion piece or a draft. And I don't think it's much more for the sides to both sides to come together and agree on this. So that's my disagreement, and that's the long and the short of it.
I understand that, Mr. Chair. I'm going to follow up because the fees shall not exceed $2,000. So somewhere in between that amount is what will be awarded, but it can't go over $2,000. It's established by rule, which means you have input in that process. Is there any other place in the statute where there's a matrix of fees set up in statute?
I'm not proposing it in statute, Senator Walker. No. I don't know of any such place. All we're asking as part of the MLAC process, and we had hoped we were there, we felt we were there, was an agreement on what this really is going to look like.
Other questions?
Well, I'd just make a comment, and Mr. Lundin, I think Senator Walker hit it on the nail on the head. I know you've probably participated in rulemaking with the department before, certainly familiar with it, and the purpose of rulemaking is to bring all the vested parties together and through a public process to determine, you know, how this all looks. And it's probably the best process we have. So that people have the opportunity in a thorough disclosed environment in order to come to consensus on what works for all the parties involved. And I would just echo what Senator Walker said. I think this is the best way. I wouldn't want necessarily to say, well, here's my matrix. I mean, I don't see that as a workable solution, nor do I see it as a barrier to moving forward when you have the concept. In fact, I think other than the processes in this body, the political process, that that is a more open environment in order to discuss all the different aspects involved in putting this together. And I would just say that I think the bill as written with the dash two making it very clear what the overall parameter is to bring your company, SAFE, workers, others together, those who represent the trial bar together to make sure this matrix is fair. So I would be supportive of the dash two, and I just really don't see the harm here.
Well, what I'm going to do here is recess this hearing for a short while, 25 minutes or something like that, and ask these folks to step out in the hall and talk about a little bit, see where we're at, and then we can get on to some. We have two other bills, and we can push out different times. So I'll recess the public hearing and we'll convene it sometimes later today. And there's other people that do want to testify, and I want to give them an opportunity also to testify. So I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 734. Mr. Johnson.
Senate Bill 734 reduces rate of interest for calculating minimum non-forfeiture amount. No revenue impact. May have fiscal impact, but no statement yet issued. Dash one amendments.
Okay. Welcome, John.
Yes.
Lewis.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Pacific Region Director for the American Council of Life Insurers, which is a national trade group of life companies that write the vast majority of life insurance, annuities, 401ks, 403bs, disability insurance, and long-term care in the country and also in Oregon. I'm here today to speak in support of SB 734 and also in support of the Dash 1 amendments, which I believe that you have in hand. The ACLI has sought, with the help of regulators nationally and also with legislators, the introduction of this type of legislation in many states around the country in order to deal with increasing problem of very low interest rates and a current minimum non-forfeiture law which provides a 3% guarantee on many of our annuity contracts. And this has become a real problem, especially for short-term contracts where, in essence, we're being asked to guarantee a 3% minimum and we can only get in the marketplace between 1% and 2% on short-term investments. If you look at the Wall Street Journal recently, you'll see that short-term investments for Treasury bills and other safe investments are ranged between 1 and 1.75%. And we never thought we would get to this point. When the 3% minimum was set in 1978, it was chosen because people thought that was the lowest possible interest rate anyone could ever imagine. Well, we've obviously dipped below that. So that thus the need for adjusting our sights here in 2003. As I mentioned, more than 20 states have already adopted a reduction in the minimum non-forfeiture law, and we've worked with the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, on a solution that would not just lower the rate temporarily but permanently and put something in statute that would adjust the minimum rate over time to reflect changes in the actual marketplace. The Dash 1 amendments achieved that goal. Those were approved by the NAIC in March with the help of Oregon and other regulatory groups, and we're advocating that those amendments be adopted. I'd be happy to answer any technical questions on what those do, but that's our basic premise, and we appreciate your hearing and support of the bill.
Thank you for coming. Let's watch you give your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lewis Little-Hales. I'm with the Insurance Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we worked with the industry on these amendments to integrate the National Association of Insurance Commissioner changes to the Model Act, and we support them.
Questions from the committee?
Yes, thank you. Just clarify for me, because I'm just reading the amendment for the first time. What impact does this have on people with existing annuity contracts? I'm concerned about retroactivity and taking away a contract right that someone had when they purchased this product. Could you maybe shed some light on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzger, I should have pointed that out. SB 734 only applies prospectively. It does not affect any current contract. So the answer to your question is it will not affect any current guarantees that are out there. But I should note also that the bill has a transition period. So it becomes effective in January of 2004, And then there's a two-year period during which companies can choose to market under the old law or under the new law. And then on January 1st, 2006, they have to use the new law.
And this then that it comes a floating rate tied to Treasury.
Exactly. The minimum rate would be, instead of a fixed 3%, it would be a range depending on the five-year average Treasury rate adjusted. And so it would float with the market. If it goes up, great. If not, there's a floor of 1% and a maximum of 3%.
Okay. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, this is fascinating because I have a bill in another committee about property tax appeal interest rates, and we're trying to do the same thing because the interest rates are darn low right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to take a look at how you've done that. Thank you for bringing that.
My pleasure.
Is there any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to see no further testimony. We'll close public hearing of the work session on Senate Bill 734. Chair would move the Dash 1 amendments. Any comments, question on the Dash 1 amendments? Any objections? So ordered. And the Chair would move Senate Bill 734 as amended to the form of the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. I'll carry that. And we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 749.
Which is a public hearing?
Public hearing. A public hearing. I'm sorry. Public hearing on Senate Bill 749.
This committee is sharp today.
Senate Bill 749 allows private community care providers to participate in workers' compensation self-insurance pool established in 1999. This is MLAC approved. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Very good. We got Nan and Todd. You both want to come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nan Heim, and I represent the Oregon Rehabilitation Association in support of Senate Bill 749. And with me is Todd Hennelly from Empire Pacific Risk Management, which administers the Oregon Nonprofit Employers Trust, the subject of Senate Bill 749. And I'm going to start by explaining why this bill is before you, and then Todd can help answer your questions that you might have about it. Senate Bill 749 is, we hope, the last legislative step in a process that began about 5 years ago. In 1999, MLAC recommended the termination of the workers' compensation refund that had gone to a number of our programs for many years. And our programs, just to remind you, are nonprofit organizations providing jobs and housing to about 6,000 adults with disabilities. The refund for us was great for some of our programs which got it, but for programs which provided residential care, it was no help at all. They got none of the refund, and they still obviously had workers' compensation coverage costs. Consequently, in 1999, we somewhat nervously supported Senate Bill 288, which the legislature passed to phase out the rebate, and to set up a work group to look at ways of helping all nonprofit community care providers with their workers' compensation costs. And that work group included representatives from our programs and other community care providers, as well as staff from Legislative Fiscal, Department of Human Services, and the Department of Administrative Services. The work group recommended to the 2001 legislature that $1.1 million be taken from the last year of the refund and be used to start a self-insurance trust for nonprofit community care providers for workers' compensation insurance. The 2001 legislature actually approved that recommendation in a budget note to the Department of Human Services. And Unfortunately, several months later, the AG's office indicated that actually we ought to have statutory language, as well as the budget note. We were able to get a provision in one of the special sessions in House Bill 4039 that to set up the trust. Unfortunately, the language in that bill limited participation to rehabilitation facilities only, which meant that only those vocational programs that had originally received the rebate can participate in the trust. That was clearly not our intent, nor was it the intent of the work group established by the legislature. And that brings us to Senate Bill 749. The trust was started about a year ago, and it is underway, and we hope that you'll support this bill to expand potential participation to other community care providers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Certainly, where is this money coming from? You formed the trust, and it's coming from where again?
I'm sorry, my ears are all stuffed up. Can you repeat that?
Where is the money coming from?
The money, which has already been allocated, came from the last year of the workers' comp refund that went to our programs. In other words, these programs got 75% of their workers' compensation payments back in a refund. Actually, for 25 years or something, that was in effect. And it eventually was up to about $4 million in a year. And it was phased out, and $1.1 million was taken from the last year of the refund in 2001 and used to start the self-insurance trust. So the money has already been spent.
My name is Todd Henley. I'm with Empire Pacific Risk Management. My firm is the administrator for the Oregon Nonprofit Employers Trust. I'm simply here to answer any questions that you might have with regards to how the trust operates, what its goals are, and those people and organizations it may serve.
Thank you, Todd. One of the issues that was brought to my attention was loss histories and financial strengths of the new group members having a negative impact upon the trust as a whole or the money that was available. Can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question correctly, just so you can understand, the $1.1 million was not a number that was picked out of the ether. It specifically allowed the program to operate as a 501c3 and is tax exempt because it is made up of organizations that are also 501 organizations. The money was also used primarily to satisfy Workers' Compensation Division security requirements for the program. The Workers' Compensation Division set a sum of approximately $417,000 to act as security for the establishment of this program. The equity issues that you brought up, other aspects of the workers' compensation requirements are that there is sufficient equity to fund the program if it were to have negative years, and so and in a way that losses were in excess of the premiums that were collected. The program is a self-insured group, and as a result, buys both specific excess coverage and also aggregate coverage, which protects it from a single catastrophic occurrence or several catastrophic occurrences that could take place in the course of a year, much like an insurance company would buy reinsurance. So the trust is also protected in that way. That's required by the state. So if you're asking anything over and above that, I hope I've answered the primary question.
Questions from the committee? Just for the record, I want to indicate that along those lines of concerns, I contacted John Schultz, who is the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. He's a regular testifier in this group, and asked him that same question. And basically, he said, in summary, there's significant oversight of group self-insurance plans. The department has sufficient authority to require this group to post adequate security. We are aware of the potential risk inherent in 749, and we'll be watching this group very carefully. The process explained to them provides safeguards to minimize the risk, and I think that was the concern, is where is the risk at? So you're very comfortable with that statement. You
Yes, I'm very secure. Just so I could add on to that, anytime an organization wishes to join this group, we of course have specific underwriting standards that any coverage provider, any insurance company would have. But any submission that is made is actually made through our organization and submitted to the Workers' Compensation Division. There are two self-insured specialists who actually take a look at each individual submission from each organization that wants to join ONET. And it must have not only the endorsement from my organization, but also from the Workers' Compensation Division before that organization can actually join. And one of the prerequisites, obviously, is their claims history as compared to losses, as compared to premium, and also their equity status, two primary things. So we collect 990s, P&Ls, balance sheets, along with loss history as part of each submission of each organization that joins.
Any questions? We'll, I'll give a copy of this to the Mr. Schultz's letter to the members and also make it part of the public record.
Okay.
Thank you.
Have no further people signed up to testify on this, so we'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 749. There are no amendments, and the chair would move. Are you on the room, Senator Walker?
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 749 unamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 749 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I can carry that. Is there anything you want to carry it?
Well, you've got three wrapped up today.
Well, you can carry it.
She's on a contest there.
Is there?
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, very good. I see some of the players.
Players are back.
Back on Senate Bill 563, so we'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 563. And,
nobody knew.
Chuck, what?
You want me here with you?
Please. We've been here from the start.
Okay.
Senator Nelson, Chuck Lundeen again from Liberty Northwest. Mr. Elmer is here as well for, representing the trial bar. And we've, as I mentioned, been interested in this concept and supportive of this concept and worked with the trial bar from the outset on this issue. We want to continue to do that over the next 9 days, and we'll have an agreement which would form the basis or a recommendation from two interested groups, very important players in the system, for the rulemaking process. I think the idea is to put that in front of MLAC on the 18th and bring this thing back to you.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Randy Elmer. I'm a private attorney here in Salem, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. What Mr. Lundeen has represented is accurate. We had agreed to the concept of going into the rulemaking process and talking in terms of let's have a matrix to determine how those $2,000 or less in fees should be paid. And it would be the idea that if someone over at the department is assessing a fee, it will be easy for them just to go to their little matrix and figure out the time and the amount of benefit gain, and they could reach a decision without a lot of effort. And I think that's important for Director Schultz's staff to be able to do that. We had never agreed on specific numbers within that matrix, but at this point we're agreeing to sit down and try to do that and take those to MLAC as Mr. Lundeen has stated. But I'm just going to say on the record that is within the parameters and the restrictions of the administrative rulemaking process. Our recommendations, even if presented jointly, may be rejected. We're just two of the players in a big system. But we'll make our very best effort in trying to reach some consensus on what that should look like.
Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I still think it's pretty clear, and the rulemaking process sets it out. But if they want to take time to duke it out, that's fine.
Okay. That's good. We'll do that.
Don't prefer. Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wait your return back. We had some other folks testify in Holly, Summers, Maria, who was in Cali, Carragher, and Michael Sue. You folks wish to come and testify. We've got about 15 minutes, so
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's going to be a lot less than 15 minutes. My name for the record is Maria Carraher. I'm the Ombudsman for Injured Workers, and I would love to give you just a view of what's happening today, if you allow me to do that. Sure. I'm not here to represent DCBS. I'm here as the advocate and ombudsman for the injured workers, and I hope that we can work something out. Obviously, the Ombudsman's Office receives many calls from injured workers that are upset, confused, distraught, and many of them relate solely to this issue. Last year, we received 364 calls from injured workers that asked us to help them find an attorney. We can't do that. The workers' comp law specifies that an injured worker has the right for an attorney to represent them at no charge. But there's no guarantee that anyone will take the case and represent the injured worker. Again, it is very difficult for an injured worker to understand the workers' comp laws that are very technical. They're constantly changing. Workers are definitely at a disadvantage when they enter a litigation process in the system. They're intimidated by the process. They don't understand the legal language. And they have little or no chance of really winning anything. In all fairness to the injured workers off Oregon, they should have access to an attorney. And in all fairness for the attorney, they should get paid for what they in fact do. So with that, I conclude. Be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for giving me the opportunity and time.
Yes, well, thank you for coming. And did you say that you're not able to recommend an attorney? How does that work when they call you and they say they need an attorney? How do you handle that?
We cannot find, Mr. Chair, we cannot find an attorney for them. It is the attorney's choice to take the case or not.
You give them a list of attorneys, or how does that work?
Usually we tell them to go to the yellow pages in the phone book and find attorneys that practice in that specialty. But when they have contacted 10 or 50, and the answer is no, thank you, I don't want to take your case, injured workers become very colorful and demanding. I would like to share a little example. Last week, I had a gentleman call me saying, well, what good are you if you can't help me? And he continued to say, if I would have broken the law and would be put in jail, somebody would feed me, even let me watch television, and give me an attorney for free. And you can't do anything for me? And unfortunately, the answer was, no, we can't. But this is the issue that we're dealing with today. It used to be we had maybe one call a month. They now have graduated to one to two calls per day. And it is troublesome to see those numbers. Thank you again.
Questions?
Just one. Ms. Carraher, I was going to ask you for your phone number so I could refer constituents, but if you can only refer them to the phone book, please tell me what your office does and what your phone number is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I hate to say this, but you almost sound like an injured worker. What do you do? Allow me, I'd be happy to provide the phone number. Would you like to write it down?
I'm writing.
Toll free, 1-800-927-1271, locally, 503-378-3351. We do assist injured workers, and occasionally we allow ourselves to provide information for the worker. I had one case today where the worker was actually talking to a church in my office. Worker was unable to find an attorney, and I offered the ombudsman services for informational resource only. I still believe the worker is at a disadvantage.
And, Mr., I would agree with you, and I also refer injured workers to the Injured Worker Coalition, who work very hard on behalf of workers. So thank you for what you can provide to workers, and hopefully we can pass this bill and give them greater assistance.
Thank you. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Holly Summers for the record, and I'm a Portland area attorney who represents injured workers. prior to law school, I was a claims examiner for an insurance company, which has provided me a perspective from both the insurer and the employer and injured workers. And I think that's relevant to my testimony today. In the area of workers' compensation, the legislature has taken the unusual step of regulating attorney fees. And with this regulatory authority comes a responsibility to ensure that injured workers have legal representation in the system. Fees must be set in such a way that workers can be represented in their legal matters concerning their claims. There are real and important benefits to providing reasonable attorney fees in workers' compensation matters. If the fees are not reasonable or unavailable altogether, then the attorneys will be unable to continue to represent the workers. In a large part, workers' attorneys are the checks and balances for the insurance company. Alternatively, the state would need to provide increase its monitoring and sanctioning and take on a huge responsibility to investigate each complaint. And I can't even imagine the fiscal impact of that on the system. Another valuable thing that workers' attorneys do is provide the workers with information. As you've heard testimony of today, it's a very complicated system, and the Ombudsman's Office, with the wonderful job they do, can only do so much. But there is a problem. There are many areas within the workers' compensation system that do not provide for reasonable attorney fees or attorney fees at all. And Senate Bill 563 addresses a couple of these areas. And as you've heard, for example, a worker who has a compensable claim and the claim has been accepted by the insurance company might need, for example, a surgery, and the insurance company might refuse to pay for the surgery for one reason or another. There is a dispute and a mechanism to resolve the dispute, but there's no provision for an attorney fee for the worker. In fact, even if the worker had the means, had the money, they could not pay for an attorney. They could not hire an attorney, or more accurately, an attorney could not accept funds under our current statutory scheme to litigate that issue for them. So really, by not providing attorney's fees for these issues, you are cutting off access to an attorney altogether. And these types of areas contribute to a more general problem. That is, workers are not able to find any representation for their workers' compensation matters. And experienced attorneys are reducing their workers' compensation practice or getting out altogether. And compounding the problem is that new lawyers are not choosing workers' compensation claimants' work. The system is complicated, the caseloads are huge, the statute of limitations are extremely short, and the cases are increasingly difficult to win, and the pay is among the lowest. In the summer of last year, I had the opportunity to review the list of workers' attorneys in the state of Oregon that are in the workers' compensation section of the Oregon State Bar. And In my review and the review of two other attorneys, we counted only 95 attorneys out of the 10,140 attorneys in Oregon who represent injured workers. That means that there are less than 1% of the attorneys in Oregon that are representing injured workers, and the problem is increasing. The solution is for the legislature to ensure that there are fee provisions for all areas of workers' compensation litigation and that the fees are set reasonably. I would urge you to pass Senate Bill 563.
You're talking about defense attorneys, $130 to $165 an hour. It's $2,000 limitation. Is this truly going to be enough to compensate you? Or how does that all work?
You know, I wouldn't say that it would fully compensate. I think that would be not fair to say that. But the truth of the matter is that most of us who take on workers' compensation cases don't take on a little bit of the case. We take on an entire case. And if it means that we have to go litigate the issue that we're not going to get paid for, sometimes we do that. It comes part and parcel with taking the claim, but it certainly factors into our decision of whether or not we're going to take a claim if a lot of the issues are going to be things that we cannot get paid for.
Say they're at $100 an hour for attorney fees. 20 hours, that's not much time. You could eat up 20 hours pretty quickly.
That's right. And the other big factor there is that my understanding of what the matrix that's been proposed is that we only get paid if we win, like every other case. So $100 an hour, even if we win 50% of the time, now we're talking about earning $50 an hour.
So you're taking most of the cases on contingent fees, basically.
Well, we have to. I mean, that's the way we're paid under statute and under the rules, is that we only get paid if we win.
It will change that, though.
No, it will not.
So you're taking contingent fees.
That's right. So you have to be real careful when you talk about hourly fees. Hourly fees, you know, might seem reasonable, but and I put in my testimony, there's a lot of other factors. You can't say claims attorneys should be paid the same hourly fee as defense attorneys, because you're not comparing, you know, apples to apples. You're comparing apples to oranges. Number one, we only get paid when we win. Number two, and there's a lot of factors in here, we only can get the, you know, defense attorneys get to bill for their mail, their copying, their secretaries. We are not allowed to do that. Also, we incur a lot of costs. For example, in a medical services dispute, we might need to go and approach the attending physician to go ask some questions, and he's going to bill us. Now, when the defense attorney does that, the insurance company reimburses him separately outside of his hourly rate. That doesn't happen. We are not allowed to be reimbursed costs from the insurance company. Sometimes we can get them from our clients, but that's the exception in my experience. So if you want to talk about hourly rates, all of these factors, to be fair, need to be considered.
Questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Summers, your testimony was incredible. I found on page 2 when you were talking about how the worker, even if they could hire an attorney, couldn't get the attorney paid. I can't believe that that's even in law, because I do know that a corporation has to be represented by counsel. And so the insurance company can hire counsel and can prosecute the case, if you want to call it prosecute. And yet the worker doesn't have that same advantage. It's just truly unbelievable to me, and I really thank you for responding to the chair's comments about costs and fees, and how you really, it is comparing apples to oranges. And that's why the administrative rule process is a good place to resolve this issue, because all parties can come to the side and table and talk about that, instead of setting it up in statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions here? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming down.
Thank you.
Michael. I'm going to testify.
Mr. Chairman, given our hallway time, he is looking forward to testifying the next time he's ready here.
Oh, so. Okay. Very good. Ed Johnson, we've got 2 minutes. We have another committee coming in at 3 o'clock, so.
No problem.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not
a mindful. Always come again, sir. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Edward Johnson of Toledo, Oregon, and I am an injured worker and somewhat of an expert in pain of this field. I was just informed 10 days ago that my surgeon wants to do another surgery on my neck. My neck's been fused twice, so technically it's been broken twice. My neck's stretching on my spine. What gets to me, my frustration to a degree is when you try to call an attorney or the ombudsman, you know, the ombudsman really can't do much for you. They basically tell you to call someone else or get an attorney. In the state of Oregon, it is extremely hard to find an attorney that will work on a workman's comp case. I've been fighting my case since 1989. The evidence that I turned in has MRIs dating all the way back to 1990, where I had herniated discs in my neck were compressed in my spinal cord. I lived like that for 8.5 years with one disc in my spinal cord. So I know what chronic pain is in fighting the insurance company, and it's just appalling that the insurance company gets away with coming up with reasons not paying on injured workers, and they always come up with an excuse saying that it is our fault.
Okay. going into this particular, well, this is talking about attorney's fees.
Right. Dealing with attorney fees, if we're going to increase our attorney fees, I want to make sure or to have the anticipation to believe that the attorneys are actually going to fight for the disabled workers. In my case so far, since 13 years I've been fighting this, so I haven't really seen it. Attorneys are not interested in a workman's comp case because even though you could have a valid lawsuit against the company too, they don't want to be involved in that. It's not a quick fix for them to make money. So I support a bill that if it's going to help the workers, and that's what we need. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You did it just right in time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Okay, well, we'll close the public hearing and we'll go back and do their work and hopefully we'll keep things back. So we'll close the public hearing and we'll also close the public hearing of the Senate Committee on Business and Labor.
Hey, I haven't said hi to you in a while, but.